And we really have a problem with something that is endless. You know, we have so much on our plate and so many things going on that we want closure. We want the report done. We want the kids picked up. We want, you know, the house cleaned, whatever it is. We want it done because that way we can take it off our plate and we feel like we'll have one less thing that we have to contend with. And I think that's why something like meditation is difficult for people, because they feel like, well, when do I get done with this? When am I good at this? And it's this when you say, well, it's just something you do forever. That's a very difficult concept, and it's an uncomfortable concept for people until you begin to see the benefits of it. When you begin to see the benefits of it and how it impacts your life and your self-power, then that starts to dissolve and you start to go, yeah, I get this. I want to participate in this forever because I want this ability to continue to expand.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Today's episode of the podcast is sponsored by HostGator. So we're in the second week of the new year, and maybe you have a creative project that you're yearning to start. And I always say that one of the easiest ways to start any sort of creative project is to build a website. In fact, I think everybody should learn to build a website, regardless of whatever their job is, because it's one of those skills that will always come in handy and you'll be able to use no matter what situation you're in. And fortunately, our friends at HostGator are perfect for helping you to get started, because they're providing 24/7 live support via phone, chat, and email. They have an easy-to-use website builder if you're not tech savvy, one-click WordPress installs if you want to use WordPress, and if you want to switch from an existing host, they make it super easy. And they're offering 30% off all of their hosting packages for Unmistakable Creative listeners. So visit hostgator.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for 30% off. Tom, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Yeah, it is my pleasure to have you here. So I came across your story actually by way of your publicist, who sent me a copy of your book, Fully Engaged. And as I was saying, you know, just before we hit record here, part of my interest in this whole idea of full engagement is the fact that I am myself, I'm writing a book on creative habits and deep in the midst of a chapter on flow and how we actually get fully engaged with our creative work and how it impacts our performance. But before we get there, I want to start with a question that I think has always been very interesting to start with. And that is, what did you want to be when you grew up, when you were a kid? And how did that end up impacting the choices that you've made with your life and your career?
I think what I wanted to be, at least when I was old enough to figure that, to actually have something that I wanted to be, was probably a professional musician. Mm-hmm. And I did experience that, but the way that impacted where I am today is that I was absolutely terrible at practicing anything. I had no discipline when I was younger. And I was aware of this. The observer part of my personality was very aware that I had this this creative side of me that was always in search mode for something else to go after, and I would get very intense about it and want to take off after it and get very excited, but I would burn up that initial enthusiasm fairly quickly. And then after that happened, then I would find myself in this very familiar struggle to keep myself going. And that would be because I was very attached to the goal and, you know, whatever it was that I was trying to accomplish. And for example, with piano, when I started on the piano, I could hear all this stuff in my head that I wanted to be able to play. And obviously when I sat down at the piano, I couldn't do it. And I didn't really have any perspective on how long it was going to take me to do that. The whole thing just seemed insurmountable. And so I ended up not continuing. After about 9 months, I quit playing. I came back to it later. Interestingly, when I was probably about a senior in high school, I was really aware that I had this behavior that I repeated over and over again that I just described. And I knew that I had to change it. Otherwise, I was never going to accomplish anything I wanted, and I was never going to have any self-power. So that decision that I had to change it, my awareness of it was very clear to me, but I had no idea how I was going to do that. Mm-hmm. And when I was in my first year at the University of Delaware, somebody, a close friend of mine, was taking a Religions of the World course, and he handed me his textbook, and I began reading on all the Eastern thought, which brought in this Zen mind and present moment functioning and all this sort of thing. And I, for some reason, it was like somebody flipped a switch. And at the very same time, I had started back into the piano with a very high-level jazz improvisational teacher. And so the two of those coordinated so that I was able to begin to develop this present moment functioning, and I became pretty proficient in playing and actually did play professionally for quite a few years. Mm.
So, you know, that ability to change behavior, especially when it comes to some sort of a creative habit or some, you know, incredibly ambitious endeavor where, you know, when you're looking at it from the start, the obstacle seems insurmountable. You managed to do that. I'm curious, what enables that kind of behavior change for the person who seems to burn out, you know, especially the one that starts out with so much enthusiasm? Because, you know, I've seen this with a lot of people who start creative projects, even blogs, for example. I think the standard sort of rate for any online project is most people quit after about 90 days because of exactly what you're talking about.
Well, I think that the number one cause is that we are taught bottom line mentality. So we are very attached to the goal itself as opposed to the process of achieving the goal. And that's really it in a nutshell. I mean, we spend 99% of our time achieving our goals and in a very short period of time actually having the goal, I mean, actually realizing the goal. And so we become so attached to this moment that we're going to achieve this goal that what that does is it immediately puts us at war with the process of achieving it. The process becomes this nuisance that we have to go through so that we can get to this place out here where we can actually hold the goal in our hand and say, now I have it. And I really think that that's where we fall down. And once we begin, you know, if you look at it like a race, one of the things that we have to remember is that the reason any of our goals are satisfying is because of the process that we went through to achieve them. Mm-hmm. If I draw a line in the with a piece of chalk on the sidewalk and say, there's the finish line, step over it, it means absolutely nothing. But when you have to prepare for a marathon and then you have to run the marathon, when you step over that same chalk line at the end, the reason it holds so much value to you is what went into actually getting to that point. And I think when we can begin to become engrossed in that and to take that on as to envelop it and to make it and to understand that this is where the joy is. This is the reason this is satisfying. It's because it's a personal expansion that is happening to us in every moment. It's one that we're experiencing right now in this moment. And that means that we're missing that because our mind and our attention is not on what we're doing right now. It's on this thing in the future. And I think it's really a paradigm shift that we need to learn. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting for you to say that because, you know, as I mentioned, I'm in this book about creative habits. And one of the things that I'm learning is that the thing that I enjoy most is actually the process. Like, as I was looking back at it, I thought, you know, yeah, getting to hold the book in my hand when it was finished was very cool, but I would give anything to be right back in the middle of it. That was where I found the most joy. But, you know, the thing that I think comes up in my mind is, okay, that's easy for people like you and I to say who have managed to do this and hold this finished book in our hand. And for the person who hasn't, they in their mind, you know, it's really easy to understand what you're saying intellectually, but I think to actually change their behavior based on understanding this, I think poses a challenge. And I'm curious what you have to say about that.
Well, I would say before you can do anything that we're talking about here, the very first thing you have to do is some thought awareness training. And the reason I say that is because what you're describing there is that people cannot separate themselves from the emotional content of what they're experiencing. I mean, it's their emotions that make them feel like this is difficult, it's unpleasant, I don't want to be here, I want to be over there. And they're in their thoughts, they're actually participating in their thoughts as opposed to being objective and observing their thoughts. And if you can't do that, if you can't experience that that separation, because that's really where the power is, and that's really where the release comes from and where it begins to be a real knowable experience. So I always tell people that the very first thing you have to do is practice thought awareness training, and you can call it meditation if you want. It really needs to be something like a following your breath series or repeating a short phrase, but it's in that practice that two things happen. One is you become more aware that you are not your thoughts, that you are the one that experiences your thoughts, and some of the thoughts that you experience, you intend. In other words, you have a, you're planning a goal, and you've got to write the stuff out, or you're solving a problem, and you're working that out. Those are thoughts that your mind is serving you. It's working as a problem-solving machine. But because the mind likes to solve problems and it doesn't like to be idle, it will go into search mode if you don't give it a problem. And that means it's generally someplace other than where you are now. And most people, we spend our lives just going along with it wherever it's going and experiencing all the emotions that are related to the thoughts that it's firing off. And then we are people say, well, you know, how do I become more present moment? And my response is, well, you have to know when you're not being present moment. And most people don't know that. They're just not being present moment. It's like, how do I become more patient? Well, you can't switch back to being patient if you don't know you're being impatient. You're just experiencing impatience. And that's the conundrum. And it's the paradox here of as you begin to become more aware that your mind is here, but you yourself is here, and you need to pull the mind back into what you want. That's when you get the privilege of choice and being able to use your mind and say, this is what I want you to do, because this is where I have decided we're going to go. And that comes from this process of watching your, sitting quietly. And it's so simple. The mechanics are so simple. I mean, sitting quietly and watching your body breathe. And what will happen very quickly into that is that your mind just takes off because it says, this is boring. I don't want to be here. There's got to be a problem I can chew on. Mm-hmm. So it just takes off and you go with it. And then what happens is when you're intentionally trying to watch your breath, you will wake up and realize that you're someplace other than watching yourself breathe or saying your phrase. And it's in that microsecond that you expand, your awareness, your self-awareness expands. And when that happens, what you gain from that is you gain this increase in awareness of what your mind is doing and that you are not your mind. And you also gain the willpower to pull the mind back, because you have to pull it back to whatever the task is, saying your phrase or watching your breath. And it's kind of, it's amusing to me when people do this and they say, well, first of all, there is no such thing as a bad thought awareness training session or meditation set, whatever you want to call it. There's no such thing as that. People say, well, I'm not very good at it. And I say, why do you say that? And they say, well, because I'm always chasing my mind. And my response is, well, you can't be chasing your mind if you're not noticing that your mind is running off, and that is the goal. So if you're chasing your mind a lot, it means that you're noticing your mind a lot, which is great. You're getting a lot of reps in, just like you're at the gym. Mm-hmm. So don't look at it as a failure. Look at it as as an indication that your awareness is growing. And I think that it's very important for people to see that. But as that happens, it's such an amazing, magical thing, because it's so, mechanics of it are so simple and it's so subtle. But what begins to happen is you begin to be outside of your thinking process and you begin to direct it instead of just being a puppet of it. And that's when you really start to gain self-power and you begin to do the things here that we're talking about, where people say, well, I haven't experienced that. Well, that's because you're being run by your mind instead of the other way around, and you're not even aware of it.
Hmm. Yeah. So I want to ask you a question. This is out of morbid curiosity, because I've had quite a few meditation teachers. We've even had a former Buddhist monk here as a guest. One of the things that I've heard over and over is that it's not necessarily the length of your meditation sessions, but it's the frequency, the repetition that actually allows you to get the benefit from it. So you don't have to go to a monastery in India or sit in an ashram for 10 weeks. You can literally derive the benefits of this from 2 minutes a day.
Oh, I totally agree with that. In fact, when I was, it's because it's the way that not only the mind works, but it's also how, you're creating a habit of thought, a habit of functioning, and habits are created through repetition, and the repetitions don't have to be for a long period of time. I remember when I was studying jazz piano, my instructor said, look, I would rather you practice 10 minutes a day, every day, than practice 3 hours on Sunday afternoon. Because it's the time period, there are things that are happening in between the actual practice sessions that you're not aware of. And, this is part of mastery. When we are working at mastering something, for example, I play several instruments and I've always wanted to play drums. So I just started on the drums. And when I first started, you're doing these independent rhythms. And so because I'm right-handed, the rhythms are very easy for me to do with the right hand, but not so easy to do with the left hand. So I start tapping out these rhythms with the right hand, and then I have to do it with the left hand. Well, when I first start to do this with the left hand, it's just not there. I mean, it just says, I don't know what you're talking about, and it doesn't want to follow my instructions. But what's interesting is because I'm aware of how the mind works and how the synapses are formed and all these things, I just ignore that, and I just continue to intend for my left hand to do what I want it to do. And within 2 days, it's starting to obey and it's starting to do it. But it takes time. It takes the training and execution and then rest, execution, rest, execution, rest. And when people can realize this and they can let go of this thing of, I have to be here in order to be happy, in order to be successful. And I think that what happens, particularly with because of our culture, everything is based on the climax, meaning if you watch television commercials, they always show the people own the $50,000 car. They're in the big house. They have the big job. Everything, they're already there. They're already at the end of the whatever their endeavor is. There's never any emphasis on the process of getting there, which is where the joy is. And then we carry this in everything we do. It's not how much you study. It's what grade you got on the test. That's what matters. And they wonder why people cheat. Well, that's because, you know, we're taught this stuff from the time we're kids, that this is what matters is getting the end result. And that gets carried into a meditative practice. We feel like I should be at this level now. And it's amusing to me. And it's also, we resist it because when you meditate, a meditation practice is like, it's like exercising. You know, you never get to a point in physical exercise, whether it's yoga or some sort of interval training or something like that. You never get to a point where you go, well, I'm done. I don't need to do this for the rest of my life because I've mastered exercise. It doesn't work that way. It's part of healthy living and maintaining a mindset and a physical body. And a meditative practice is the same way. And we really have a problem with something that is endless. You know, we have so much on our plate and so many things going on that we want closure. We want the report done. We want the kids picked up. We want, you know, the house cleaned, whatever it is. We want it done because that way we can take it off our plate and we feel like we'll have one less thing that we have to contend with. And I think that's why something like meditation is difficult for people, because they feel like, well, when do I get done with this? When am I good at this? And it's this when you say, well, it's just something you do forever. That's a very difficult concept, and it's an uncomfortable concept for people until you begin to see the benefits of it. When you begin to see the benefits of it and how it impacts your life and your self-power, then that starts to dissolve and you start to go, yeah, I get this. I want to participate in this forever because I want this ability to continue to expand.
Mm. So walk me through sort of the trajectory of you know, studying music in college to how you ended up doing the work that you did. Because I know it's been this very sort of varied career from having read the book. And I'm curious kind of, you know, what have been sort of the major inflection points that have led you to today?
Well, when I was at the University of Delaware, my major was actually turf and horticulture. I was going to be like a superintendent of a golf course. And so it was a roundabout way to get into what I'm doing. But because I always had a love of music. I had started playing the guitar when I was 4 years old. We didn't have a piano. I studied seriously for several years. And then the instructor was sick and had to give it up. And then we got a piano when I was 9. I took lessons for, I don't know, maybe 10 months. And I was a terrible student. And I quit then. But I had this tremendous love for music. I could hear it all the time in my head. I had all these ideas for arrangements and compositions. So when I was at the University of Delaware, as I said, I was studying jazz piano, and I got it myself into a position where I had fulfilled all the degree requirements for the degree I was in. But what disturbed me was that they were basically telling us, and particularly in the herbicide class, is that there was this a lot of evidence that the herbicides that were being used on the golf course were causing brain cancer and all sorts of stuff. And I said, you know, this might not be a good road for me. And I just didn't know which direction to go in. And so my father suggested that I go into piano technology because I absolutely loved the piano. And it, you know, it seemed like a good idea. I was 19 at the time, and I started that business, and the business took off, and it got, it became so successful. By the time I was 23, I had every credential offered in the country. So I was also the only, it was an octogenetic career in terms of everybody in it was my father's age. And so, you know, by the time I was in my mid-20s, everybody was that it was in my area was getting out of it. And they were just handing me all of their business. So my business became extremely successful and very big. Now, the reason I mention that is because everything that you do on a piano is at least 88 times because you got 88 notes, but usually it's hundreds of times. And for example, you know, a piano action, the keyboard system has about 5,000 parts and about 34 adjustments per note. And every adjustment is interdependent on every other adjustment. So if you turn adjustment one, it's going to affect all the other adjustments. So you basically have to constantly refine these adjustments as you go through what they call regulating the action. And because I had become the chief concert technician in the area on for so many venues, I was constantly having to prepare pianos for the highest level players, the best classical musicians in the world, jazz musicians. They were all, I was meeting them all and spending time with them and talking to them about discipline and all those sort of things. And but also having to prepare the instrument. And these people were pushing the instrument to its limit. So everything had to be absolutely perfect in order for it to keep up with them and be a transparent interface. So that was part of it. But the other part was that I had gotten into full-scale remanufacturing of grands, which is a very esoteric skill, all handwork, chiseling, and again, repetition like you cannot imagine. Just like unbelievable repetition in very small detail work. So at the end of the day, I was working 6-7 days a week, 65 to 70 hours a week, and I was almost all of my time was in solitude. I worked by myself, and when I would come into a theater to work, everybody left, and I would just be on the stage by myself for hours with the instrument, and they wouldn't come back until I told them I was finished. Many times I would go in at 4 o'clock in the morning if I had to, you know, because there was stuff going on in the theater so that I could have a quiet place to work. And so I spent a lot of time by myself doing this incredibly repetitious work, which gave me this wonderful incubator for working with this Eastern thought. And then I had gotten into sports psychology and found that they were basically two sides of the same coin. But I had this opportunity to constantly apply this stuff and see how it made me feel, how it made me perform, what kind of a difference it make, and just constantly refine it. And that's really where all of my writing came from. And that's where, you know, going through that period of all during that time, I was learning the, you know, jazz improvisation. So I work on the piano and then I play. And so I spent all this time in solitude working with repetition and mindfulness. And it was years of this. And that was really where all of my writing came from. As I was growing up in school, I was always told to be a writer. I didn't do that in school because I was so busy with musical compositions. But by the time I would write for myself, but by the time I got into my late 20s, early 30s, that was when I conceived of writing The Practicing Mind, which was my first book, and the one that preceded Fully Engaged.
So, you know, having been a musician, you know, in high school, and also, you know, having spent insane amounts of time trying to get an understanding of what it is that allows mastery of any craft, I'm curious, you know, what are the lessons about mastery that came from all that time spent in solitude? And also, you know, doing something as esoteric as restoring grand pianos that clearly, in my mind, involves a lot of craftsmanship.
It does. And I think, you know, learning to be, learning to use your goal as a rudder, you know, which is one of the comments that I've made over and over again. You know, you need a goal because the goal serves as motivation, but it also serves as steerage. You need to know where to direct your energy. So I also one of the things I do is I have a pilot's license, but I also sail. And if you look at sailing, you know, the wind is the energy. But if you don't have a rudder on the sailboat, then the thing just gets blown. The energy is just dissipated. The boat just gets blown sideways and all around the lake or wherever the bay or wherever it is you're sailing, and you end up not going anywhere. And so it's important that you have a goal. But again, the problem is this thing of feeling like when I reach this goal, that's when I'm going to experience happiness. In fact, I've always thought that sailing was a really great metaphor for mindfulness because, you know, there's a saying in sailing that when you leave the marina, you've reached your destination. The reason you pick a destination to in sailing is so you have some place to sail to, so you can experience the process of sailing the boat. So, you know, so you leave the marina and you go, hey, let's sail down there, which, you know, 8 miles away. Okay, now you've got some place to direct the boat, but it's the experience of actually managing the sails and the wind and the tide and, you know, watching out you don't run aground. And if you do, how you're going to get the boat. It's all the creativity that goes into it. It's the experience of all of that that makes it joyful. And so I really learned, you know, by myself, because I wasn't distracted with conversation, I was able to, for example, if I had to build a bridge for a piano, you know, you've got hundreds of little pins that have to be drilled in there, hundreds of hand chiseling work that has to be done. And you could sit there. It wasn't that you just had to do that on a piano, but I had like 3 years of workbook. So you'd be sitting there chiseling the bridge on this piano that you knew was going to take you maybe 2 weeks, but you had five pianos stacked against the wall that were waiting for you to do them. And so you had to find joy in this whole experience of remanufacturing pianos in this moment. And that became so apparent to me with such clarity that I really started to work at it. And when I did, I began to experience that this joy of I'm right where I am. I didn't see everything that had to be done. All I saw was what was in front of me. And when you do that, your thinking slows down, your thoughts thin out, and you have access to all of your consciousness, as opposed to a mind that's running all around and going, yeah, but what about, you know, that piano over there? I know that's got a particular problem I haven't dealt with before. What am I going to do when I get to that? And, you know, I had this problem last week. I'm not sure it's absolutely fixed. I'll have to wait and see if the customer calls me back. See, the mind isn't doing all that. It's only notching this bridge right now by hand. And when you do that, it's really a complete release from all the stress and from this feeling of attachment and incompleteness of I got to be over there. I have to have this. No, there's just me, this tool, and this bridge. That's all there is. And I had to experience that for myself. But once I did and I saw how freeing that was and what a joy it was to just be completely absorbed in the moment of what I was doing, in this process of rebuilding this instrument, it began to translate into other things. You know, I started studying golf, and I would go into my basement at night and after work, and I would do maybe 200 swings in front of a mirror, and I would do them in slow motion, and I would sit there and I would break the swing down into like 20 different parts. Just I'd do 10 swings in slow motion just looking at my feet and focusing on that, and then just focusing on my knees, and then just focusing on my hips. And then I became so absorbed in the joy of just being absorbed in the process of learning a golf swing that I became very creative. I would put on a set of headsets in the dark and put a film score on that was very pastoral. And I would slowly swing in total darkness to feel the balance of my body. Now, how did this translate out? Well, when I began getting with PGA Pro instructors, I was a total anomaly with them. I mean, they would tell me, I've never seen anybody that has progressed as fast as you. I've never seen anybody with a golf swing that has such a fluid motion. Well, that was all because of all this stuff I was doing. You know, to me, it was just this joy of when I would have a stressful day, to be able to go down and shut everything off. The kids were in bed. I was done talking to my wife, and you know, like, and now I'm just completely immersed in just this process. I don't have to be anywhere else. I think once people begin to see that, and I have found this in coaching as I work with people. I've worked with people that were like, for example, one guy was a surgeon. And, you know, he was just in surgery, running to do paperwork, in surgery, running to do paperwork. And after we worked together for a couple of weeks, it became this total joy. He found that he was in this complete mindfulness while he was getting comments from his the people in the operating room saying, something's changed in you. And he was seeing himself completely immersed in this process of doing surgery, completely immersed in this process of doing paperwork. He said, you know, he was coming out at the end of the day refreshed and with a sense of contentment. It was a complete turnaround for his experience of life. And that's really what I try to teach people is you can do this. This can be the natural way that you think. We just haven't been taught to do this in our culture.
Mm-hmm.
Today's episode of the podcast is brought to you by The Ultimate Game of Life. So my business partner, Brian, and I went through this course last year, and we found it so valuable that not only are we doing it again to start off 2017, but we're having our new hires go through it as well. Play The Ultimate Game of Life, and you'll see measurable results in three foundational areas: your health, your wealth, and your happiness. Sign up for their exclusive free seminar by visiting unmistakablecreative.com/tug. Again, that's unmistakablecreative.com/TUG. Today's episode is also sponsored by HostGator. So as I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, I think that one of the easiest things that anybody can do to get themselves started on a creative project of some sort is to just build a website. Sometimes just going through one action, even if you don't know where it's going to lead, can lead to a lot of other things. In fact, that's how many of our own projects at Unmistakable Creative have started. And fortunately, our friends at HostGator are fantastic for helping you to get started because they're providing 24/7 live support via phone, chat, and email. They have an easy-to-use website builder if you're not tech-savvy. They have one-click WordPress installs, and they make it really simple to switch from an existing host to HostGator. And they're providing 30% off all of their hosting packages for Unmistakable Creative listeners. So visit HostGator.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for 30% off.
The question that raises, obviously, I think is really, you know, at the heart of what this book is about is how do we do that on a daily basis? Like, you know, I guess let's look at it through the lens of a practical example, because some of that, you know, really struck a chord with me. So I'm in the midst of a book, but I know that, you know, one of the things that happens is it takes me about an hour before I hit flow. Like, I know for a fact that pretty consistently the first 1,000 words will be crappy, and then suddenly I'm kind of like, wow. But there's a lot of things that I have to do to make sure that happens. So I'm curious, you know, how do people bring about this sense of being fully immersed or fully engaged in whatever it is that they're doing on a consistent basis? Like, how do you make this a daily habit?
Well, it takes practice for one, and it takes non-judgment for one.
Okay.
I think that's the big thing, is because where does judgment come from? It comes from this feeling that you should be at a certain place. And one of the things that I wrote about in Fully Engaged is, in general, when we set goals, and the goal here is to be in flow, to be fully engaged all the time. Well, you know, that's somebody, a family member of mine, called me one day and said, you know, I tried to be present moment yesterday and it didn't work. And I said, well, the problem with that sentence is the word yesterday. I said, you can't, you know, you've never worked at this, and you're starting out trying to be a Zen master. You know, even the Zen masters don't stay completely present all day long. I said, you know, you have to do something like, you have to pick goals that are realistic, using accurate data. Like, I'm going to be mindful from 9 o'clock to 9:05 to start. But what we do is, you know, as a culture, you know, we want everything's big, win big, work, you know, no pain, no gain, all this stuff that we were fed day in and day out. So we begin to judge where we are with this, based on this subconscious sense of this should take this long and we should be at this place here. You know, a story I've told many, many times, I had one of the people I worked with had quit a corporate job and wanted to become a visual artist. And when she contacted me, I asked her what she was struggling with on the first session. And she said, well, I've been at this for 6 months and I'm not as good as I should be. And I said, well, that's, you know, that's an honest perspective. How good should you be? And there was silence. And she said, well, you know, I guess I don't really know. And I said, well, if you don't know how good you should be, how do you know you're not better than you should be for the average person that's been doing this for 6 months? And she said, well, I never thought of it like that. I guess I don't know that either. And I said, well, if you can do what you do now, if you could do that 6 months ago, would you have thought you were good? And she said, oh, absolutely. And I said, so it's not that you're not moving forward and getting better. It's that your perception of how good you can be is expanding as you move down the road. I mean, this happens in any art form and in anything. You know, when we start out, you can't have an idea of what your potential is when you start out. You learn that as you go, and things you can't even imagine begin to present themselves to you. So I think that I tell people, look, if you want to be fully engaged all the time and you start out there, you set yourself up for failure, because what you've immediately done is you've set this goal of when I'm here, I'm not fully engaged. I'm almost never fully engaged. But when I can be fully engaged all the time, and that which is what I want, then I'm going to be happy. Well, you've already created this gap between where you are and where you need to be. And it's been created with the spirit of the only reason I'm doing this practice is so I can get to this point over here. The practice is this nuisance I have to do. So now it's, you're not enjoying the process, and actually, you know, the present moment is all there really is. The rest of it doesn't exist. The future and the past doesn't, you know, it's only right here. So you give, what you've basically done is betrayed yourself, and you forfeited the opportunity to experience becoming fully engaged. And the other paradox is, when you're fully engaged, you don't know that you're fully engaged because you're completely absorbed in what you're doing. If you go, hey, I'm fully engaged. No, you're not. Now you're thinking about how you were fully engaged. And so that's the paradox. It's really kind of a game. But as I said, as you practice thought awareness, what will happen is that you start to become very clingy to some point other than where you are, because you will not be that thought. You will just notice that pull. You will feel the pull. You will notice that you're separate from it. And you won't judge that you have started, that you've fallen off the wagon. You won't judge it. You go, oh, look at this. I'm going over there. Come on back here. It's like a parent with a toddler in the toy store, and they're just running around because they're just seeing all this stuff that they're excited about, and they just keep pulling them back online. No. We're back here. We're walking through the aisle. This is the way I want you to go. I mean, that's the mind. The mind just wants to explore and go problem solve and look for things that it finds interesting. And as you become better at more farther along in your thought awareness, you'll basically be watching this, and you will be in control. You have the willpower to pull it back. But it's a mistake to enter something like this, like with this idea of, and I even say this, like the practicing mind. What is practice? Practice is the repetition of a process with the intention of achieving a specific goal. And without judgment, it's a series of refinement, constant refinement. Everything that we do in life comes from repetition and refinement, whether it's learning to walk, learning to talk. When we first started the walking, it's like you're up, you're down, you're up, you're down. But the balance starts to happen. The brain starts to figure it out. It's this repetition of this action with an intention. I want to walk from here to there. And the mind figures it out, and you get better at it. And now, as an adult, you walk across the room, and you don't even think about it. Well, it's the same thing. You don't judge. This judgment thing, to me, is the enemy. It's like if you take a basketball player who's shooting foul shots, and he shoots the first shot, and you watch the ball, and the ball's short, it's left, it's long, it doesn't go through the hoop. Now, if he looks at that and says, and intuitively says, this is what I need to do on the next shot, that's the most efficient way to perform, and it's going to be the most productive, and his experience of shooting the foul shots will be the most contentful. But if he slams the ball down and goes, I cannot believe I was left on that, I practice this all day long, and rah, 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 and this thing starts rolling around in his head, and what's happening? His experience of the moment has deteriorated, and so has his performance. So that's why I'm saying, we have to really guard against this thing of, this is what I want to do. And you need to say, I want to be fully engaged as much as I can. That's your target. That's, like the archer. You got to have something to shoot at. That's your target. But when you begin to judge your progress, based on how many arrows that hit the target, then that doesn't improve your performance. It only makes your experience of getting better at it unpleasant.
So you've alluded to performance, multiple times. So I can't help but ask you, what is the impact on performance across, a variety of fields of this whole notion of being fully engaged? I mean, I have my ideas of it. Like the moment you mentioned fully engaged in performance, I think Steph Curry raining down three-pointers. So I'm just curious kind of what you've seen in the lives and work of people in terms of the impact that this has on performance over the long haul.
Well, virtually all of the studies in sports psychology, focus on non-judgment and being in the present moment, letting go, executing and letting go. And they also focus on the fact that you cannot learn and perform at the same time. So you have to make a decision. I've worked with young golfers, and I was out on the course with this very talented young man, I said, now I want you to make a decision today. I said, now you can break it up from one hole to the next. I said, but when you stand up on the tee, I want you to make a decision. Am I learning on this hole, or am I performing on this hole? Can't do both. So if you're learning, that's when you begin to look at things like, I'm going to try this, I'm going to watch this, I'm going to make these, I'm going to try experiment with these decisions. If you're performing, then you have to approach it differently. And I think that there's a story in The Practicing Mind that I read. I've shot target archery before, and so I was very interested in reading up on this years ago. And there was an Olympic coach. I'm pretty sure it was in the 1970s. And back then, the Americans, all this stuff was new. Not a lot of people were into sports psychology. It was actually becoming. It was in a state of becoming at that time. And what had happened was this American coach said that the Asians, you just couldn't compete against them. And the reason was because the Americans were very attached to getting bullseyes. The only reason they put the arrow in the bow and drew the bow was to see if they got a bullseye. The Asians were completely absorbed in the process of drawing the bow, and the target just got in the way. And that was because all of their focus was on this process of drawing the bow, experiencing it, breathing correctly, all these things. They were completely detached from the goal, which was obviously to get the arrow in the bullseye. So their performance was way above everybody else that had this typical Western thing was, it doesn't matter if you don't get a bullseye. So the Americans would shoot, the arrow would be left of the bullseye, and then they would begin this self-judgment, negative self-talk and all this sort of stuff, and then try harder, their performance would go down. It would set up this cycle, and they were not competitive. So I think, if there's one thing that we know for sure, not just from looking at Eastern thought that's been around for thousands of years, but also looking at all the empirical Western studies in peak performance, is that when we are in the present moment, we are functioning at our highest level, and our experience of what we're doing is also one of contentment, even bliss. And, our performance is very high. And it's, so this is the thing that you're starting to see this coming into corporations, because if they don't start to take this on, they're going to lose their ability to compete, just like in sports. Because now if you go into sports, it's everywhere. It doesn't matter whether you're talking about track and field, football. I mean, everybody's talking about, we got to stay in the moment, we got to stay focused, we got all this stuff. And in golf in particularly, which is where it's really been studied, and that's because it's a non-reactive sport. It's really very much a zen sport. I mean, the ball just – if you look at like baseball – The pitcher throws the ball at the batter, and the batter just has to react to it. Same thing, like say with tennis. But if you look at golf, this ball just sits there for as long as you want, and it just waits for you to swing at it. And so the mind can really interfere. All these different parts of the mind, the analytical mind, the judgmental mind, they can all get into this scenario and say, boy, whatever you do, don't hit this left and all this sort of thing. And so you have to learn to discipline that and just be in this process of swinging the club and learning to let go and everything that goes into the modern sports psychology of the golf swing. So it's an area where they've really been able to work on it and see how it impacts players. But as far as performance goes, it's everything.
What is the impact of technology on all of this?
Well, I guess you could come at that from two ways. I mean, one is that technology, for me, has created problems, but it's also served to prove all this stuff. For example, if you look at a golf swing again, we can put a suit on a golfer and that has sensors on it, and then he can be filmed, and these sensors are mapped out, and the computer can analyze their golf swing, and it can analyze the perfect golf swing, and then it can overlay this person's golf swing on a perfect golf swing. It's amazing technology. It can show where all the weaknesses are. Now, the reason that that's a good thing is because it's one of the things that predicated this mental study, in my opinion, into sports, because we had reached a point where, from a physical standpoint, a physical prowess, we were peaking. We passed the point of diminishing returns. If we know what a perfect golf swing is, and we can teach it to someone from the time they're a child, then, and if you look at like say Lydia Ko, who's 19 years old and has won all these tournaments, absolutely incredibly amazing young golfer. But now she's struggling right now. So if she has this golf swing that works, she has this ability. Why can't she do it all the time? And that's really what I think, pushed things, not her personally, but that scenario is what pushed things into that arena where they were saying, look, you know, we can give the person some these exercises, this nutrition, all these things that have to do with the, making the physical body operate at the optimum level. After we do that, what's next? We, you know, there's why do, you know, even though we do all that, we still can't get this this high level of performance all the time. Where's the missing link? Well, it's the mind. The mind is what's controlling the body. So from that standpoint, the technology really created or really helped us move forward and be able to study this and find out that from a Western standpoint, I mean, it was already known in the East, but from a Western standpoint, we could stand back and say, oh, you know, here, all of our decades of research have shown that this is when we function at our highest level. Where it's a problem is that we are hyper-connected in our culture now, where through our smartphones, our tablets, the television, everything. And what is happening is that our minds are being constantly fed stimulation. And, you know, we never have, you see these people, it's an addiction looking at their phones. You see four people sitting at a table at a restaurant, they're not talking to each other, they're all looking at their phones. And they can't resist the technology. I love the you know, the irony of the advertisement. It's like, stay connected, and they're not even connected to the person that's sitting next to them. You know, like they're looking at their phone. It's crazy. And in fact, you know, as a sailor, I read an article not too long ago where somebody was a writer for a sailing magazine, and the guy was in he was in the Caribbean sitting on a sailboat in a marina with one of those amazing Caribbean sunsets, and he said the thing that struck him was there was a family of four on a chartered sailboat right next to him, meaning that they had rented the boat. I guess the father or mother had a charter license so they could rent a bare boat and take the boat for themselves for a week. He said the two parents and two kids, teenage kids, are sitting there on this boat next to them with this incredible sunset in back of them, and each parent was on their own iPad and each kid was on their smartphone. He said, like, they came here for this, and they're completely addicted to these phones and looking at what they had missed a text, but, you know. So that to me is where the technology has we're just too connected. And because of that, the marketing media has this constant connection to us. So it can constantly make us feel like, well, you can't be happy where you are because you're not driving this car and you're not on this vacation and you don't have this house. And, you know, all these things, which, again, creates dialogue, internal dialogue, and level emotional responses, which ramps up internal dialogue. And so instead of the technology quieting our mind, it's serving to agitate the mind. So there's really two sides to that coin of what is technology doing. You know, well, it's taught us things, it's allowed us to learn things, but at the same time, it's also a problem.
Wow. Well, this has been incredible. You have packed it with so much insight. You know, so much of what you have talked about has helped me, you know, process a lot of things that I've been struggling with for the last few weeks with my book. So I'm very happy. I asked a lot of questions that I did for very selfish reasons, but hopefully they've been helpful to people listening. So I have one last question, which is how we finish all our interviews at The Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
For me, it's how they view their place in terms of their dharma, how they view, you know, are they attached to serving other people and finding joy in that, or are they self-serving? And because I think that what, for me, that is the thing that is so noticeable to me. We always notice people that, even a simple thing, like I have found that, like, if I'm in a checkout line, and the person, you know, that's, in fact, this happened to me last week. I was in the grocery store, and the girl that was doing the checkout was just kind of overwhelmed and was clearly not having a good day. But she had a name tag on, and her name was Amanda. And so when she started doing my groceries, she was doing her best to put a smile on and go through that. And when she finished, I looked at her and I said, thank you, Amanda. I really appreciate everything you did for me today. Well, if you could have seen the change in her demeanor and her face, just because I called her by her name and showed some appreciation, it made such a difference in her, and I think probably started her on a different on a different foot. She smiled, and I could see the tension leave her. So I think it's, you know, I watch people, and I know what it feels like for me when people are aware enough that they're extending some kindness and attention. I think it's an unmistakable characteristic in people that really shows forth.
Well, like I said, this has been just amazing. Where can people learn more about you and your work?
Well, they can come to any one of my websites, tomsterner.com. They can come to the practicingmindinstitute.com, which is what I founded this past year. And it has, there's free stuff you can join. There's a lot of stuff coming up, some online course stuff, mastermind things that are happening where we're, you know, I'll work with a group of people for like 5 weeks for a very inexpensive fee. There's all sorts of stuff that we have coming on for 2017. And basically what we try to do is to take, everybody gets to pick something in their life, and then they learn to apply this present moment functioning to that particular thing that they're struggling with. And because the goal is to get people to function this way naturally, not to have to be trying to do it. When I was younger, I didn't function this way. I learned it over a period of time. Now it's the way I see everything, and so it's completely transformed my life, and anybody can learn that.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that. Next time on The Unmistakable Creative.
The way I've been teaching it recently is just change the but to an and. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I want to be a writer, but I don't have any formal training. You know, I want to be an actor, but I'm really old. I want to be a health coach, but I'm super fat. Like, no, you want to be a writer and you have no formal training. You want to be an actor and you're old. You want to be a health coach and you're super fat. That's part of what you have to bring. That's the magic. That's your way of doing it.
Samantha Bennett joins us to talk about starting right where we are.